Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Big congratulations, guys. We've recently become the single most popular podcast in the world, overtaking the Joe Rogan podcast with 18 million listens on our most recent episode. So very well done. Really impressive that a little podcast about literature could take over the world like that. How funny would it be if that was... How weird would that be if this podcast was huge like some other podcasts? A little podcast about old books. It kind of wouldn't work too, would it? Would it be too much? I like this little community. What am I talking about? Why am I doing this? Do you know why I'm doing this? To stall, because I'm still loading my page. Anna Karenina, Part 2, Chapter 7. Would Anna be wise to dodge this bullet? Or is Vronsky being legit? And how will Mr. Karenin respond to this when he works it out? I Am Norwegian said, the Sir John Anna was held up by is based on a real man. He was a missionary who spent time in St. Petersburg. The aristocrats welcomed him and his message of personal salvation through independent Bible study. The New Testament only became available in modern Russian translation in 1876, having been banned for political reasons earlier. Sir John, real name Granville Waldegrave, was banned from Russia 2 years later. What year is this book set again? I felt kind of bad for Alexei Alexandrovich, so full of trust that he was completely oblivious to Anna and Vronsky negotiating the extent of their infidelity 2 feet away. What year is it set? That's a good question. Does it tell me at the start? Just flicking back here to the beginning of the book. List of characters. Nope, that's not what we want. It doesn't say. What year is Anna Karenina set in? It is set in between 1874 and 1876. So, how far off are we? Oh, it's about to become available in Russian. So he must have been on the front lines. Techrific said, I'm not so sure of that. He was lured into that conversation with Betsy, but he happily accepted it because it's a subject within his purview and comfort zone. To me, he seems like a typical institutional man. He can't be bothered with real life, or at least the quotidian life. He has fled into the corridors of power, not to embrace life, but to avoid it. Isn't that curious that he was the sole person not to look once in their direction or be distracted from their interesting conversation? I find that unconvincing. No matter how engaging a conversation, our eyes wander involuntarily, don't they? I think he's purposefully avoiding looking at his wife. I think he knows or suspects something, but he just doesn't know how to handle or approach the subject. Even if he doesn't look directly at them, he must notice, unless he's blind, that every other eye is on them. That surely must tell him something's afoot. I had the distinct feeling that he knew. He must. I mean, everyone else is gossiping about it, so surely that gossip has reached him by now. And if not, you know, you usually can clue onto that thing pretty quickly. When your partner is flirting with someone else, it's usually pretty obvious. You know what it looks like when they flirt. You know their moves. So, I think he's doing that thing where when you do think, oh, my girlfriend is, or my wife is, having a flirt over there with someone else, well, there's not many moves you can do, really. You can't confront them about it because then you seem defensive. I think that's the move, isn't it? You just kind of let it play out, right? Shrug it off. That's what I would do, at least. And then, you know, if they pursue it, then you've got a problem. But if not, then it was a harmless bit of a flirt. Yeah. That's usually my move. Because I suppose, well, anyone who would say that would probably say they're not really like the jealous type. Yeah, so I'd say that would be me too. I think I would get jealous if it led to something. But in those opening skirmishes of people who were caught each other's eye, I don't know. It's one of those catch-22 situations, isn't it? When you find yourself in that situation where there's no real move where you don't... There's no move that sits completely right with you. I Am Norwegian said, if Anna was caught cheating, it would reduce him to a cuckold. Even if he was uncaring, I imagine he cares about his reputation as a statesman. If these kinds of people that go to any length to avoid controversy... It's these kinds of people that go to any length to avoid controversy. Even if he was uncaring, it would be a very embarrassing and detrimental thing for him to simply turn a blind eye. It's much easier for me to square him being oblivious and myopic than uncaring. That being said, we don't really know Alexei yet, and I'm pretty sure that 90% of my predictions so far have been proven inaccurate within a few chapters. Yeah, the whole cuckold thing. Ugh, what a word. I think it depends what... Not if he allows it to happen, it's more his reaction to it. I think, like, the definition of a cuckold is it's like someone who stays with their partner after they've cheated more than allows them to cheat. So if he turns a blind eye and then finds out, oh, look, they hooked up, I'm going to separate from her. I wouldn't call that a cuckold. I'd just say, yeah, I don't know. It's if he takes her back, I think that's then when you say that, right? Isn't that how it works? I don't really know the rules of cuckold. I really don't even want to say that word anymore. It's so gross. It's a gross word. I think that would be my move. Let him see what happens. Because you don't want to be the guy that just prevents it by being confrontational. I'd be more like, oh, watch them. And if she does go through with it, then you're like, oh, I suppose she's not the person I thought she was. Maybe we should not do this anymore. And then you separate entirely. Go your way into the night. It's much easier for me to square him being oblivious and myopic rather than uncaring. Nearsighted is myopic. That being said, we don't really know Alexei yet. I'm pretty sure that 90% of my predictions... Oh, I've already read this, haven't I? I have. I don't think he's uncaring, says Tegrific. His retreat into his work doesn't mean he doesn't care for Anna. My point was that he did notice, but didn't know how to handle it. Maybe he doesn't care. That could be a thing. Like, oh, if she cheats, I suppose I've got an out from this unsatisfying marriage. Then I can sort of say it was her fault that we split. Maybe. I don't know. Eula is a pimp said, Tolstoy has a way of really making you loathe these scenes with the aristocracy. Yeah. Well, does he? All of War and Peace is the aristocracy. And you kind of just start to feel like it's normal. Like it's... That you kind of feel like, oh yeah, that's where I would have been if I lived back then. Chances are you would have been a serf or something. Alright, anyway, let's move on from this discussion and read chapter 8, which goes like this. Karenin did not see anything peculiar or improper in his wife's conversing animatedly with Vronsky at a separate table, but he noticed that others in the drawing room considered it peculiar and improper. Therefore, he also considered it improper and decided to speak to his wife about it. Oh, well, there we go. There's everything I just said goes out the window. Cool. When he reached home, he went to his study as usual, seated himself in his easy chair and opened a book on the papacy at the place where his paper knife was inserted. He read till 1 o'clock, as was his wont. Only now and then rubbing his high forehead and jerking his head as if driving something away. At the usual hour, he rose and prepared for bed. Anna had not yet returned. With the book under his arm, he went upstairs, but tonight, instead of his usual thoughts and calculations about his official affairs, his mind was filled of his wife and of something unpleasant that had happened concerning her. Contrary to his habit, he did not go to bed, but, with his hands clasped behind his back, started pacing up and down the rooms. He felt that he could not lie down till he had thought over these newly arisen circumstances. When Karen had decided to talk the matter over with his wife, it had seemed to him quite easy and simple to do so, but now, when he began considering how to approach her, the matter appeared very difficult and complicated. He was not of a jealous disposition. Jealousy, in his opinion, insulted a wife, and a man should have confidence in his wife. Why he should have confidence, that is, a full conviction that his young wife would always love him, he never asked himself, but he felt no distrust, and therefore he had confidence, and assured himself that it was right to have it. Now, though, his conviction that jealousy is a shameful feeling, and that one ought to have confidence, had not been destroyed, he felt that he was face to face with something illogical and stupid, and he did not know what to do. Karenin was being confronted with life, and the possibility of his wife's loving somebody else, and this seemed stupid and incomprehensible to him, because it was life itself. He had lived and worked all his days in official spheres, which deal with reflections of life, and every time he had knocked up against life itself, he had stepped out of its way. He now experienced a sensation, such as a man might feel who, while quietly crossing a bridge over an abyss, suddenly sees that the bridge is being taken to pieces, and that he is facing the abyss. The abyss was real life. The bridge was the artificial life Karenin had been living. It was the first time that the possibility of his wife's falling in love with anybody had occurred to him, and he was horrified. He did not undress, but paced up and down with his even step on the resounding parquet floor of the dining room, which was lit by one lamp over the carpet of the dark drawing room, where a light was reflected only from a recently painted portrait of himself which hung above the sofa, and on through her sitting room, where two candles were burning, lighting up the portraits of her relatives and friends and the elegant knick-knacks, long familiar to him, on her writing table. Through her room he reached the door of their bedroom and turned back again. From time to time he stopped, generally on the parquet floor of the lamp-lit dining room, and thought, yes, it is necessary to decide and to stop it, to express my opinion of it and my decision. Then he turned back. But express what? What decision? He asked himself in the drawing room, and could find no answer. But after all, he reflected before turning into her room, what is it that has happened? Nothing at all. She had a long talk with him. Well, what of that? Are there not plenty of men with whom a woman may talk? Besides, to be jealous is to degrade myself and her, he said to himself as he entered her sitting room. But that consideration which formerly had weighed so much with him now had neither weight nor meaning. At the bedroom door he turned back, and as soon as he re-entered the dark drawing room, a voice seemed to whisper that it was not so, and that if others noticed, that showed that there must have been something for them to notice. And again he repeated to himself in the dining room, yes, it is necessary to decide and stop it, and express my opinion. And again in the drawing room, at the turn into her room, he asked himself, decide what? And then, what has happened? And he replied, nothing. And remembered that jealousy is a feeling which insults a wife, but in the drawing room he came again to the conviction that something had happened. His mind as well as his body performed a complete circle each time without arriving at anything new. He noticed this and rubbed his forehead and sat down in her room. Here, as he looked at her table, at the mail sheet cover of her blotting book, and an unfinished letter that lay there, his thoughts suddenly underwent a change. He began thinking about her, of what she thought and felt. For the first time he vividly pictured to himself her personal life, her thoughts, her wishes, but the idea that she might and should have her own independent life appeared to him so dreadful that he hastened to drive it away. That was the abyss into which he feared to look. To put himself, in thought and feeling, into another being was a mental action foreign to Karenin. He considered such mental acts to be injurious and dangerous, romancing. And what is most terrible of all, thought he, is that just now, when my work is coming to completion, he was thinking of the project he was then carrying through. When I need peace and all my powers of mind, just now this stupid anxiety falls on me. But what is to be done? I am not one of those who suffer anxiety and agitation and have not the courage to look them in the face. I must think it over, come to a decision, and throw it off, he said aloud. The question of her feelings, of what has taken place or may take place in her soul, is not my business. It is the business of her conscience and belongs to religion, said he, feeling relieved at having found the formal category to which the newly arisen circumstances rightly belonged. Well then, thought he, the question of her feelings and so on are questions for her conscience, which cannot concern me. My duty is clearly defined. As head of the family, I am the person whose duty is to guide her, and who is therefore partly responsible. I must show her the danger which I see, warn her, and even use my authority. I must speak plainly to her. What he would say to his wife took clear shape in Karenin's head. Thinking it over, he regretted having to expend his time and powers of mind on conspicuous domestic affairs, but nevertheless, clearly and definitely, as though it were an official report, the form and sequence of the speech he had to make shaped itself in his mind. I must make the following quite clear. First, the importance of public opinion and propriety. Secondly, the religious meaning of marriage. Thirdly, if necessary, I must refer to the harm that may result to our son. Fourthly, allude to her own unhappiness, and interlacing his fingers, palms downwards, he stretched them up and the joints cracked. That movement, a bad habit of cracking his fingers, always tranquillized him and brought him back to that precision of mind which he now so needed. The sound of a carriage driving up to the front door was heard, and Karenin stood still in the middle of the room. A woman's steps were heard ascending the stairs. Karenin, ready to deliver his speech, stood pressing his interlaced fingers together, trying whether some of them would not crack again. One of the joints did crack. By the sound of her light step on the stair, he was aware of her approach, and though he was satisfied with his speech, he felt some apprehension of the coming explanations. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Mr. Karenin is going to confront his wife about the scandal. Very cool. That's kind of exciting, isn't it? Is it? Isn't it? Is it? Yeah. All right, have your say over on the subreddit. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.